session number 17825, Reel 2.
Mr. McGovern, Reel 2.
So we're anticipating going to the squadron where life would be so much easier, so much more free and easy, a relief from all of the drills and chasing from classroom to classroom. At least this is what we were led to believe. But at the same time, I think it has to be said that we were looking forward to doing some real flying instead of just sort of 30 minutes round the bay and shoot at a few smoke floats. We used to spend a lot of time, of course, firing a couple of hundred rounds at a drogue towed by a Lysander aircraft, or I think we had some Hurricanes that were making mock attacks on your aircraft whilst you attempted to shoot them down using the camera gun. And the film from these camera guns was then analysed and assessed your potential ability, I think, as an air gunner. However, having got a posting to 426 Squadron at Dishforth, we were sent straight from Air Gunnery School up to Dishforth. There was no leave at all. I hadn't had any leave from joining as a civilian in January 1943 to being posted to the squadron in July. Was it July? Late June, early July, whatever. And when I reached York Station, then stuck into the back of a truck with your equipment and transferred about 20 miles up the road to Dishforth Station, to Dishforth RAF Station, and as we got there, I was given a meal in the NCO's mess. I said, "Now, I don't know what the hell they've sent you here for, because your squadron's just moved to Linton-on-Ouse." Well, I think I slept the night there at Dishforth, and the following day moved to my permanent station at Linton-on-Ouse. Having got to Linton, the adjutant there kindly asked me if I'd had any leave. I said, "No, I haven't." So I think I got about 10 days leave. At that time, the crew that had come across from Dishforth were busy converting from Wellingtons to Lancasters. So I had a window then when I could be sent away without sort of being missed, and enjoyed some leave at home. And on return then met my crew, which was headed by Flight Sergeant Freddie Stewart. He was the pilot. And the rest of the crew, Rod Dunphy, Canadians, the bomb aimer, I've forgotten his name, the bomb aimer. Flynn was the wireless operator, a Londoner. Flight engineer, another British lad, Frank Taylor, and the other gunner, Canadian, George Andrews. Then, of course, we started training on the Lancasters, as the, presumably, was the pilot and flight engineer who were being familiarised with the Lancaster aircraft, its foibles, its requirements. And my logbook will show that we spent a lot of time on night flying exercises, cross-country exercises, gunnery exercises. until we were deemed fit for work. And the first raid that the squadron did was Peenemünde. I did not take part in the raid myself, but it was on that raid that we lost our commanding officer, Wing Commander Crooks. He was shot down on that particular run. But I must admit that life on the squadron was, as has been promised, a much happier existence, in that if there was no flying to be done, one could report down to the flights in the morning to your appropriate office. You'd see your gunnery leader, in our case, or in other people's cases, the radio leader or the navigation leader. And once you'd been out to your aircraft, checked that everything was in good running order, in other words, did your daily inspection, very often you would go back to the flights, see your flight commander, find out that there was what exercises were on for the day, or if there were no exercises planned for the day, one could then just disappear and pop off into York and generally enjoy the day. I can recall too that at that time, as an NCO, we had been billeted in the what had been the old married quarters on the station, and there they'd taken a floor of a three-bedroom house, and a crew would be allocated to the house. You would have three beds in each bedroom, and I should say a crew would be allocated to the floor, so that you would have three beds in each bedroom, and issued with a certain amount of coal, sufficient to ensure that you didn't get warm. And we generally had the life of Riley out there, because we obviously it wasn't very long before we found a convenient hole in the fence, and just behind the married quarters was a house that had been taken over by the local, I think it was the Church Army people, where they'd set up quite a pleasant canteen for us with a snooker table, and coffee was available, and buns. And we used to spend most of our time in there, I think. And then a little further down the road, we had the College of Knowledge, as it was called, the College Arms, where very often at night, if you didn't want to go to the into the mess, you could make your way down there, and you could guarantee that either they would have plenty of glasses and no beer, or plenty of beer and no glasses. The number of times I've seen airmen queuing up waiting for someone to finish with his glass so that he could go and get his pint of beer. However, I think that generally speaking, everything was novel and new. The smell of brand new aeroplanes was something exciting, certainly nostalgic as far as I can remember. Finding yourself sort of, instead of someone who was being chased about from pillar to post by generally miserable NCOs, corporals who had nothing better to do, you are now a person with some dignity and authority. And responsibility, of course.
How were you regarded in the RAF, as RAF air crew, by members of the public in those days?
I've got to have a great deal of sympathy for the members of the public in those days, because the local people, particularly at Linton-on-Ouse, which is a sleepy little village, and who probably only saw, prior to the war, two or three strangers in a month, were suddenly swamped by an army of people in RAF blue, some with Canadian flashes on their shoulders. And I won't say that we were treated with disdain, that's not true, but we were simply matter of fact, every day, part of their village life. When we got down into York, there that seemed to be the hub of activity for the whole of the RAF, because of course there were numerous squadrons all the way around Yorkshire, and most of them within about 30 miles seemed to find their way into the centre of York, and in particular to Betty's Bar, where that was the hub of activity. But I think people are people. Some people accepted us with open arms. Other people were rather disdainful of these unruly, noisy young people, probably most of the older generation, and who can blame them when their lives have been disrupted to such a great extent?
So you weren't regarded as glamour boys?
Oh, good gracious, no, I don't think so. Not at all. That's not my impression. Right, well, where do you want to go from
can
here?
Can we go on to your operations now, please?
Yes,
if you can take me through what you remember of each of them.
Yes, I think my first operational exercise was with Freddie Stewart as pilot to Nuremberg. And my initial reaction to that was that it was a long, long, tiring way. It was nearly an 8-hour trip. In total darkness, with only the occasional flare en route. Discussions between pilot, navigator, wireless op were minimal, and most of it carried out in, if it's possible to believe it, would appear to be almost total silence, although you were riding within 10 feet of four Hercules Bristol engines, each developing something around 1600 horsepower. But you were in your little turret there with your job to do simply was to stay awake and make sure that you kept an ever watchful eye on the air surrounding you as best you could. And it was a long, cold trip. Even when we got to the target, I seem to recall whether or not we got there a little early, but it was pitch dark, just a little light from the stars, and our navigator was a good man, knew his business, and initially it was thought that we were in the wrong place or at the wrong time, so we stooged around for a little while. It seemed ages, but of course it was probably 4 or 5 minutes before eventually PFF opened up the Pathfinder force, started marking the target for us, whereupon we then knew that we were in the right place and just a little ahead of time. Either that or the Pathfinder force were a little late, which is probably difficult to believe. I think it more than likely that we got there just a little bit ahead of time, and we bombed, returned home. Just long, cold, lonely trip. Nothing outstanding as far as I can recall about it. The outstanding feature of that trip, as I say, in my mind, was getting to the target, waiting in the darkness for the Pathfinder force to open up and show us where we should be going and what we should be doing. Got back to the unit, and as far as I can remember, there were no particular difficulties.
What happened on a long trip like that if you wanted to urinate?
Well, you could get out of your turret on the outward leg before we left the UK, or in crossing the Channel or the North Sea, whichever your route happened to be. And there was the Elson toilet, of course, at the back of the aircraft. But then, for something like 6 hours, you just had to hold it. There was no alternative, because wearing flying gloves in temperatures as low as minus 60 degrees Fahrenheit, you needed your protective clothing, and of course the gloves consisted of your inner silk gloves, your electrically heated gloves, and your outer leather gloves. Then on your body you were wearing your outer flying suit, a heavy sweater, your normal battle dress and your underwear, and dressed as you then were, it was very, very difficult indeed to even get undressed and do anything about it. So I can't recall ever having to answer to a call of nature, except once we got within striking distance of home on the return journey. Then you would go back and use the Elson. You just had to make the best of it. It was all right for the people at the front end. They used to have facilities, I think. They used to carry a can or whatever. But you didn't want to finish up in the turret with a frozen digit.
Did anybody ever take any drugs or alcohol before or during the raid?
Yes, we didn't look on them as drugs then, but we were given these little yellow tablets by the MO to sort of keep you awake, together with your flying rations, as we call them, consisted of a bag, probably. I think it had mainly barley sugar sweets and a bar of chocolate, together with your emergency pack, which consisted of the escape equipment with currency and, I believe, a map and compass and so on, which was in a separate sealed carton kept inside the battle dress. And we had the vacuum flask with coffee, about a 1-pint flask, I think. And we also had carried a torch, and the method of making the torch usable was that the inside lens measured, an inch and a quarter in diameter. And behind the glass you fitted a disc of cardboard through which you pierced a hole with the end of a matchstick. And that was the illumination that you could use, but only inside the aircraft. However, coming back from the Nuremberg trip, I can recall that I'd thought that it would be a good idea if I got some bottles of Pepsi Cola. All of the crew enjoyed this, and I particularly did so, because the Canadians had ample supplies of it. I thought I'd laid half a dozen bottles in the fuselage, which we could use on the return trip. We'd all enjoy that. Lo and behold, of course, on our arrival back at base, find the thing just frozen solid, and I think it was about 12 hours before it was usable again. I think the ground crew enjoyed that between them. But we never did get our Pepsi Cola. And there was a silly superstition too, although I think it was probably born of practicality, that one never opened our vacuum flask of coffee until we got back over the UK. Vigilance, of course, was essential. And all of this assumes that your aircraft was in reasonably good order still. And then one would start to relax a little. And one gunner would sort of relax a little and take his drink from his vacuum flask, whilst the other one maintained vigilance, and then we would do a swap over. And the other gunner would then be able to take a cup of coffee and, if necessary, visit the Elson.
Did these yellow tablets work?
I can't recall, because I never did take them.
Why not?
The general opinion was it was all right if you took these tablets. They certainly helped you to stay awake during the night, but it prevented you from going to sleep the following day also.
Now, that was your first raid. That was the 27th of August, 1943. The second one, you put turned back, 30th of August, to Gladbach.
Yes. We were scheduled for a trip to Mönchengladbach, which was reputed to be, by comparison, a fairly easy target. However, I think we got about to crossing the channel when the pilot's escape hatch blew off. It ripped off the navigator's curtain. It ripped off the other blackout curtain further down the aircraft for the radio operator. And no one could work under those circumstances. I think we also lost our hydraulics, so that the wheels came down and the bomb doors opened. I think we had some flap on too, so we had little alternative but to turn back due to this hydraulics failure mainly, which was then an abortive sortie.
How was that regarded by the powers that be back at base?
Oh, I think it was accepted that there was little alternative. You couldn't carry on for perhaps another 3 or 4 hours with unable to achieve your height, your bombing height, unable to, with certainty, get to your target, because those Hercules engines, they used an awful lot of fuel. And whilst the ground crews were very generous very often in putting 50, 60 or 100 gallons extra into the tanks. And yes, the ground crew had real genuine concern for you, and I can so often recall the ground crew chief giving the nod and wink and saying, we've put an extra 50, 60 gallons in. Keep you going for a little while in difficulties. However, with all of the appendages hanging down, it would have been virtually impossible to have reached the target safely and got back again. So there was the usual exercise to go through of jettisoning some of the bomb load in the North Sea and returning to base. And as regards, I don't think that there was any question that we should have continued under those circumstances.
And your third raid was 31st of August to Berlin?
Yes, that was quite an experience. I can remember that we took rather a northerly route out from the UK, and I quite distinctly remember seeing, as we went out in the clear air, vortices from the aircraft engine and wings. New experience for me. I hadn't seen anything like it before. The outward leg was without any real or unusual events. One saw the occasional battle going on. One would quite often see people who had strayed from track and got themselves over some defended area, being pestered by searchlights and flak. But, I mean, this was run-of-the-mill stuff. One expected to see this. We were not personally, we were not attacked ourselves. But I can recall, as we approached the target, that was the first time I'd ever seen flares laid on the run-in to the target. And it seemed to me, although I could well be exaggerating, it seemed to me we were about half an hour running down an avenue of brightly lit flares, these things hanging down, dripping this yellow phosphorescence, where the night fighters above us had laid a flare path right the way down into the target and out the other side again. And at any moment, we expected to be shot down. And I can recall the one and only time when I rotated my turret to look forward and I saw the Berlin defences in all their glory. Searchlights, flak, and whilst it's an old cliche used by bomber command people, flak heavy enough to walk on. It seemed like that to me at the time. And I thought, there's nobody can possibly get through that and come out the other side. However, we did. And we came out of the other side.
Who had dropped these flares, did you say?
The German night fighter people had laid a twin line of illuminating flares on either side of the bomber's track into Berlin, so that we were in bright light all the way down. It was, I would imagine, although I've never been on the stage, equivalent to an actor coming out into the middle of a stage, into the spotlight, after having been in total darkness. It was startling, it was frightening, and I certainly did not expect to survive. But we obviously did. And without any great damage. I think there were minor flak holes, but nothing of any significance. But it certainly was a frightening experience. I think we got back to base without any difficulty. And after a good debriefing, breakfast, and to bed.
Then I think your next raid recorded is 23rd of September, quite a gap.
Possibly we'd had some leave. Possibly the moon had intervened. I can't recall.
This was to Mannheim.
Yes, this was my first experience of the Ruhr Valley. The Ruhr was generally looked on as